Welcome in, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us. Boy, this is a big news day for the state of Alabama. It seems like everybody in the national news media is talking about Alabama, and we all know why. I have to say, based on this bill that has passed, I've never been more proud of my state. Now, it's not a done deal yet. It does go to Governor Ivey's desk. She has to sign it before it officially becomes Alabama law. That's part of the way that our process works. However, even though I have some misgivings about our governor, even though Kay Ivey and I don't always see eye to eye on everything, she's pretty good on this issue. She's pretty good on protecting the life of the unborn, and because of that, I really don't foresee a scenario where she winds up vetoing this bill. Could be wrong. Grandma Ivey could surprise us, but I don't see that happening. She has a very, very good pro-life record, and so I'm going to kind of be treating it as though it's basically a big deal because of that. And since it is such a big deal, and because I want everybody to know about the particulars and sort of the ins and outs of this law, I actually do have a guest coming up here in just a second. It's our friend who has been on the program a number of times from the Foundation for Moral Law. Welcome into the program, Matt Clark.
Good evening, Caleb. Thank you for having me with you. It's always an honor to be on the air with you.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking some time out of your busy day to be able to talk to us about this bill. And there's a couple reasons why I brought you on, primarily because you are somebody that is licensed by the Bar Association to practice law in Alabama, and you have a little more insight than the average person on exactly how this goes, and specifically because you work for a foundation that deals a lot with Supreme Court cases. And so I really wanted you to give sort of an overview based on this law and the technicalities, the inner workings of it. What is the next step? Because as Representative Terry Collins, the sponsor of this bill, said, this bill was always designed to be appealed up and go to the Supreme Court. So what does that look like, and what do you think the odds of success are?
Well, let me see. I think it hit the nail on the head, Caleb. You're right. This bill does appear to be designed to issue a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade. Under the current framework, this would have a hard time passing constitutional muster in a court. But the state of Alabama is essentially, you know, passing this law and then daring groups like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood to come after him and say, "All right, you want to fight this out? Let's go." And it appears that, as I'm sure you know, it's because Justice Kavanaugh has replaced Justice Kennedy on the United States Supreme Court. It looks like the Alabama legislature has assessed the climate on the court and figured we probably got the fifth vote that we need to overturn Roe versus Wade now. So in order to do that, you have to get some kind of a lawsuit going. And So here, the Alabama legislature has decided to go ahead and pretty much criminalize the act of abortion in this state. So the ACLU has been watching this very closely. They've already announced plans to sue, and I wouldn't be surprised if, speaking from a lawyer's perspective, I wouldn't be surprised if the ACLU has already analyzed the bill. They've probably already got their complaint drafted, and they're probably ready to drop it the day that Governor Ivey signs it. So when that happens, my guess is that it's probably – I can't say for certain what the courts are going to do, but my guess is that it's going to go up through the federal system. The lower courts are probably going to say things like, as much as we hate this, this violates Roe and Casey, so we have to declare it unconstitutional. And they're trying to force the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case and overrule Roe.
Right, and that is the end goal, and I think that you brought up something that's important that I want my viewers to know, because as you and I actually talked about this bill a couple of days ago, and I learned something that I didn't know, I figured that this would, because of the way that it was it came about, it would eventually wind up going to the Alabama Supreme Court. That's not the case. It would actually go through the federal system.
Yeah, that would be my guess. The technical answer is it can it can go into either. It just all depends on groups like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood. It just depends on where they decide they're going to sue. Now, from a lawyer's perspective, when you have the two choices, you tend to try to pick the one that's going to give you more likelihood of success. And for the left, that's probably going to be the federal courts, not the state courts. So my guess is that's where they would probably kick the lawsuit off.
Oh, there's no doubt that would be more advantageous to them in my mind. I mean, when you've got to go up against Supreme Court Justice Tom Parker and the justices that were elected by Alabamians, you have a pretty good idea of where that verdict would come down. So, I mean, if they're And I think that the ACLU, regardless of what you may feel about them, they're smart people. And so they're going to probably try in the federal court, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. You know, we've had some really interesting turnover here in the federal court here in Montgomery, where President Trump has been able to appoint a few new judges there that have just been confirmed. So the climate may not be as favorable to groups like the ACLU as they would like, but the fact of the matter is they've got better chances of success in federal court than state. So I would imagine that's where they're probably going to kick off their lawsuit.
Okay, so I wanted to ask about a couple of misconceptions, because there have been two things that, so far as I can tell, are completely untrue that have been repeated over and over again by people that are pro-choice, that favor abortion. And this is true of celebrities, political pundits, actual elected officials. There's two big things, and the first one is that women are in danger. And as far as I understand this bill, and maybe you can correct me if there's something in this bill that is worded improperly or something like that, there are exceptions for the life of the mother, and not just the life, the actual health of the mother. So I don't see where you can make the case that women would be endangered by this bill. Whether or not you agree with the exceptions that are allotted, the danger of the woman is not something that would be called into question based on the way that this bill is specifically written.
Yeah, I would agree with you. But I think, you know, when we're debating this issue of whether there's a danger to the woman, it all depends on, you know, the lens at which you look through this issue of danger to the woman. For us, we're thinking about things like, all right, is this going to kill the mother,
right,
such as in the rare case of ectopic pregnancy. But I think for liberals that have long pushed for access to abortion through the courts, their rationale has been that if women can't get abortions, then they can't enjoy all the same rights in society that men can. You know, they're not going to have as many job opportunities. They're not going to have as much autonomy over their lives. So to them, I think that's what they're going to, you know, when they say this is going to endanger women, I think this is part of the equation for them. Whereas with us, it's like, all right, look, you know, maybe if the mother's life is in jeopardy, we can talk about whether an abortion would be necessary in circumstances like that. But beyond that, you know, your loss of job or your loss of opportunity or your loss of convenience doesn't justify killing the child.
Right. And I do think that the reason that they're making that is some of them know the difference and are making that specifically as a scare tactic, because they want to drum up this idea that there, which, by the way, this scenario is so rare that there are people that are OBGYNs that have never even heard of a scenario like this, to where the woman would be pregnant and her life is in jeopardy, but they can't abort the baby, even though that would save her. That's kind of the imagery they're trying to drum up in people's minds. But in the case of this bill and this ban specifically, that wouldn't be an issue anyway, because there is an exception specifically for the woman's life or health. And I do agree with you that there is a stark contrast between what is considered a plausible reason for an abortion. For somebody on the right, it would typically be only if there is severe jeopardy to the mother. In the eyes of the people on the left, it's basically anything that is an inconvenience for them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. This bill explicitly carves out an exception for, you know, the life of the mother. And given the current state of medical technology, I think the only case in which, you know, the mother will die if, you know, the embryo is not moved is ectopic pregnancy, which is extremely rare. And I think technology is, based on what I understand about this, I think technology is progressing to the point where, you know, the chances are more and more likely that you don't necessarily have to remove the baby, but you can just move it to its proper place. I don't know if we're completely there yet, but I think we're getting closer. But beyond that, you also mentioned the health of the mother, which I think needs to be talked about. This is the one problem that I had with the bill. It went into some pretty complicated definitions of what constitutes health. Under certain circumstances, it could encompass things like mental health. And what it said was two doctors, or in the case of mental health, two psychiatrists, have to sign off on a finding that, you know, the mother needs this in order to preserve her, I believe the term was substantial health. But in Kansas, there was a law a lot like this, and there was a late-term abortionist named George Tiller who used to pay other doctors to sign off on the need for an abortion for any reason whatsoever. And then he would cut them a share of the profits that he made from aborting the child. So one of my big fears is that this health exception that they've thrown in can be exploited to the point where a child can be aborted for just about any reason.
Well, and this was one of the scenarios that I did an interview with Representative Terry Collins on this program. And of course, she's the sponsor of the bill. One of the things that she and I talked about was, and this is the reason that she gave for the exception, which I have some reservations about, to say the least. She said, well, the main thing is the reason that we included psychological problems is because if the woman, for example, is suicidal, and if she's suicidal and she's threatening to kill herself, that would, of course, end the baby's life as well. And so because of that, we wanted to allow for this exception to take place. Now, in a scenario where you know for sure that that is what's going on, I totally understand why you're looking at that and saying, well, we don't want to lose both of them. But the problem that I have with that is that if that is the case, all a woman has to do at any point in her pregnancy is say, oh, well, I'm suicidal and I'm going to kill myself if this doesn't happen, to get an abortion. If they know that that's the exception, it's not hard for them to do that. And like you said, passing the threshold of being able to get a couple of doctors to sign on off on it is not going to be something that's a substantial barrier to some kind of fraud or just basically allowing you still to get an abortion. And this is one of the main problems that I also have with the bill.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. If you include an exception for something like suicide, then all you have to do is claim suicide and it's done.
Right.
It's I remember when the bill was being considered before the Alabama Senate, we had a similar problem with them considering an exception for rape or incest. Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to one of the moral problems, which is, well, you know, despite the fact this is absolutely terrible, it doesn't follow that you punish the child, this is the father. One of the evidentiary problems is if you leave this in, then, you know, every case of an unwanted pregnancy becomes I was raped or it's a case of incest. Mm-hmm. Not that that actually happened, but that's all that you have to claim. So in the same way, whether it's, you know, I'm suicidal or I was raped, that's pretty much all that you have to say in order to be skirt around the law. So this is one of the problems that pro-lifers need to be very vigilant about when considering exceptions to banning abortions. So
I believe this was Oliver Wendell Holmes that said this, that you have to think about law from the standpoint of the lawbreaker, not the law abider. And if you just think about this law and think, okay, if I were trying to get an abortion, and I just wanted to, for my own convenience, would it be very difficult for me to do so? And based on at least what I'm hearing, even from the person who sponsored the bill, not really. And that's the problem that I have with that, that if you include that psychological thing, being suicidal or really any other psychological problem, because it doesn't even specifically in the letter of the law draw out that scenario. It just says essentially, mental health problems. Well, what parent, even if they want the child, doesn't feel an enormous amount of stress when they're expecting a baby? I mean, if we're going to use these vague umbrella terms, then it won't be very difficult for you to get an exception. And that's the problem that I'm seeing here.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. When you think about how life-changing of an event it is when you have a baby, I'm sure, you know, like I've never, had to give myself, but I imagine that it's, you know, it turns your world upside down in many ways, not only with the stress that you feel, but when you consider just logistically how much of a challenge it is to your life.
Right. Economically, emotional, any of those things.
Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't be that hard to construct an argument saying that this is going to substantially disrupt my life and therefore, you know, substantially disrupts my health, this substantially disrupts my mental health, things like that. And if there are financial incentives for doctors to sign off on, you know, your colorable reason for needing an abortion without a way to hold them accountable, then I think it's very easy to bypass the law. So this is a loophole that I wish they would have closed off, but they didn't. So that's one problem that I have with this bill. But beyond that, I do have to commend the Alabama legislature. This was one of the gutsiest moves that I have ever seen to stand up to Roe versus Wade.
Wanted to ask about that real quick, because I do think it is a huge historic event. Since the the Roe v. Wade verdict came down from the Supreme Court, has there ever been a state that actually tried to ban abortion? Because to my knowledge, there's not. This is the first one.
Yeah, not to my knowledge either. I think there have been bills that have been proposed in a few state legislatures that have been shot down. They either didn't make it out of committee or they were voted down because, you know, the legislatures just kind of thought under the current framework, there's no way to win this. Mm. So to my knowledge, this is the first one that has been passed by both houses of the state legislature that, you know, goes so far as to say, we're going to treat the murder of an unborn child just like the murder of any other born person. So this is probably the boldest move to stand up for the right to life that I've ever seen from a state before.
Yeah, and you have to give kudos to the Senate and the House for that. I absolutely agree. There are some misgivings that I have about this bill, and I do think that as conservatives, including myself in this, sometimes when we see a big victory like this, we tend to make the mistake of being so busy running around and high-fiving each other that we forget that the fight really is just starting. It's not finished at this point, not by a long shot. And so it's a big accomplishment. I think that we ought to be celebrating, especially now that it's very likely that the governor is going to sign this into law. But I do think we also have to caution ourselves and remember that this is not a time to rest on our laurels. And also, just because you are excited about the bill and ought to be doesn't mean you can't discuss some of the shortcomings of the bill and some ways that we can sort of try to work around those things. And that kind of brings me to my second question about this, because you and I have talked about some of the weaknesses of this bill in court. As I understand it, the way that this bill exists in its current form, it does not actually technically establish the personhood of a baby, at least explicitly, maybe implicitly, but not explicitly. Is that true?
Well, I would. I think I would generally tend to agree with that. So when you're, but you know, I'm gonna reserve judgment ultimately on that. I think ultimately, you know, there are two aspects to discussing the personhood of the unborn. The first is whether you explicitly say it. I want to say there was a 1989 Supreme Court case where, I want to say it was the state of Missouri, amended the preamble of their constitution to where it talked about how the purpose of government is to protect life, liberty, and property. I think they amended their preamble to say that life includes the life of the unborn. Mm-hmm. And it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld it as constitutional. But the reason was what they said was, at the end of the day, this doesn't really have this amendment doesn't really have much teeth. You know, it's a general policy statement of what the state values. But when you look at what it actually accomplishes, mm-hmm. you know, there's not a criminal law that's in effect or anything like that. So if I remember right, I think Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was pretty conservative, wrote that opinion. And, you know, but that was his rationale for upholding it. But yes, so number one, you got to be clear about that. But based on that, I would say actions speak louder than words. And so with that in mind, when you pass a law that that says that we're going to treat the murder of an unborn child just like the murder of any other person, you know, even if you don't explicitly say that we think unborn children are people, the implication is incredibly, right. incredibly strong. And under the Supreme Court's current framework, I think they'd be looking for that more than an explicit statement that the unborn are people, but that doesn't actually accomplish something. So,
okay, good. That does clear that up a little bit, because I'd heard that from a couple folks too. And one weakness that I think is important to point out here, and I'll let you give a little bit more explanation on it, because I know you're more knowledgeable about this stuff than I am. There is an important point to be made that I've heard other conservatives, including, you know, you and I and Laura talked about this not too long ago, who used to be my co-host. One of the big problems with this is, let's just say that everything we're hoping for comes true and this works its way up through the federal court system, gets a hearing by the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially sort of narrowly says, yep, we overturn Roe v. Wade. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but let's say that happened. If that happens, that does not make abortion illegal in all 50 states. What that does is it kicks it back to the states for a question for them to resolve. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, you know, Roe versus Wade held that the due process clause of the federal constitution pretty much protects your rights. You get an abortion during the first trimester for any reason. Second's kind of a toss-up. Third, probably not, unless it's necessary to save your life. First of all, that's an absolutely moronic holding. If you read what the Constitution actually says, there's no way you can logically get to that conclusion. But what it did was, it pretty much held that as a matter of, you know, federal law, the states could not outlaw abortion under certain circumstances. So if you overturn that, that means that you undo Roe. So that's good. I mean, you know, this terrible Supreme Court decision that has resulted in the deaths of over 60 million people now has no more teeth to it. That's great, but it still doesn't answer the question of whether unborn children are people whose right to life is protected by the 14th Amendment. So you're right. Presumptively, it would rest with the states to decide that on a case-by-case basis. So on the one hand, you've got states like Alabama that have just come out with very strong pro-life laws. And then on the other hand, you've got states like New York, which just legalized abortion up until the moment of birth. And then right. The governor of Virginia that was suggesting that it's okay to, or at least that it may be okay to kill babies that have survived an abortion and have been born alive. So
right, and just to clarify for my audience, that's not a law. Mm-hmm. That was just the governor's opinion. But yes, exactly. The point is there are lawmakers that would be comfortable with making that into a law.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So if the only thing that we accomplish is overturning Roe, then it does not mean that abortion is outlawed throughout the United States. It just means that each state has the right to decide for itself. So on the one hand, that's better than the framework that we have now. But on the other hand, if we agree that unborn children are people that have an unalienable, God-given right to life that is actually protected by the Constitution itself, then we can't settle for just saying what the states decide. I know this ruffles some feathers, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. I mean, this is like saying during the Nazi Holocaust, that's like saying, well, if we get rid of Hitler, then we ought to let, you know, each of the provincial authorities decide whether it's okay to continue the Holocaust or not. But no, you know, just stop it. This should not be happening anywhere. So if we overturn Roe, that's like saying, well, all right, Hitler doesn't get to decide anymore, but, you know, the local authorities do. Whereas ideally what we want is let's just stop the Holocaust, period. Nobody gets to take life.
So, right. When your end goal is ending abortion across the country, then overturning Roe would be a really big step towards that, but it's certainly not the final step. And that's what I think a lot of people are unaware of, because you hear Roe v. Wade bantered about as though it's synonymous with legalized abortion, and to a degree it is, but you have to understand that the states and their individual jurisdictions, if that were to go away, if it were to go back to the way it was before 1973, we would essentially just be back to the point to where the states are making the decision.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So I don't know, just in terms of trying to figure out what's better than the framework we have now. If right now if the best we can do is get the Supreme Court to overrule Roe, then I mean, at the end of the day, more lives are going to be saved than if we keep the current framework. But for me, the thing I can't get past is this: the 14th Amendment does make the protection of life a federal issue if either the state is taking life without due process, or if the state is denying any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So you have to wrestle with the question of who is a person. And at the end of the day, looking at it through the lens of how the people who ratified the 14th Amendment thought, a person is not a person because the federal government says so, or because the state government says so. A person is a person because God says so. He's the one who gets to decide which human being is a person. And at the end of the day, the analysis is pretty simple. If you're a human, you're a person. And because of that, the state can't look the other way if one class of people, such as the unborn, are being murdered while everybody else's right to life is protected. So I think there is a good constitutional argument to be made that the 14th Amendment actually requires the states to step up and protect the lives of the unborn. And then when the state is involved too, like you know, for instance, if, you know, the state is providing money to healthcare plans, if it's going to touch the issue of abortion, then I don't think the due process clause lets the taking of life happen without due process for the child. So anyway, I think you've got two arguments there, that the 14th Amendment itself actually prohibits abortion nationwide, as opposed to just allowing the states to decide for themselves.
Well, and I think that there's an important analogy that I could bring up here. And you tell me if I'm in a legal sense going off the rails here. But it's kind of like saying that there is a difference in the state sanctioning it and the state allowing it to happen. So if we were to, again, apply the 14th Amendment, and it's important to remember that the 14th Amendment was put together and passed and ratified in the wake of the Civil War to grant these and extend these rights to black people. If you remember that, I think that you could say that there would be a difference in the state actually sanctioning the murder of people like, you know, Soviet Russia or Nazi Germany, and just allowing it to happen. But if there was any state that was just not prosecuting, for example, the killing of a particular religion or the killing of people in a particular race, obviously the federal government would want to step in because of the 14th Amendment specifically. And you're saying that if we can establish personhood for the unborn via the 14th Amendment, then it would sort of extend automatically to all 50 states and require states to protect them as well, correct?
Yeah, I think you absolutely nailed it. That was a great analogy between, you know, the state, you know, allowing something versus sanctioning it. But I think the Equal Protection Clause here is really the key, because it says the state shall not deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is an element of which, you know, if the state is aware that somebody is being denied equal protection and then just decides to look the other way on it, you know, you can't do that anymore. So with that framework in mind, I would agree, if we establish that the unborn children are people, and if the Constitution protects the equal protection of the laws for every person, then it automatically extends to all 50 states, and the abortion holocaust is over. So ideally, that's what we want to see for here.
Okay, so I got one last question for you, and it goes back to those two lies that I was talking about earlier about this bill. The other one is that women will be criminalized for this. I remember that there was one pundit, it was CNN. They were talking about it on CNN, and they had sort of a panel discussion, and one of the pundits was saying that the woman could be criminalized if she were raped, for example, and spend more time in jail than her rapist. But as I understand it, this bill specifically only criminalizes the doctor performing the abortion, not the woman receiving the abortion. Is that also correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The text of the bill focuses only on doctors, and it's been a couple of weeks since I've read it. But if I remember correctly, I think it explicitly says that it doesn't apply to the women. But even if it doesn't, it is a cardinal rule of criminal law.
Mm.
That if there's no law, then there's no crime. So if the law focuses just on the doctors and just prohibits doctors from doing abortion, then, you know, it doesn't touch the women at all. So even if there was a woman who knew that the state was going to prosecute her abortionist, and she came to the abortionist and said, "I don't care, I want an abortion anyway," and the abortionist did the procedure, then at the end of the day, still, only the abortionist could be prosecuted. You could argue that the woman is just as morally culpable as the doctor is, but in the eyes of the law of Alabama, the only one that's responsible is the doctor for that. So you're right. Women are not going to be prosecuted for this. And I'll say, too, when the pro-life advocates really started pushing for stronger abortion laws around the time of the Civil War, it's at that time that science was progressing to the point where we realized a person is a person from the moment of conception.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, when there were stronger pushes to outlaw abortion, the focus was only on the doctor. To my knowledge, a woman was never subject to prosecution for getting an abortion. And I think part of the theory behind that is, you know, these women a lot of times are incredibly distressed, and, you know, in times of stress may, you know, bend to doing something that they shouldn't, partially because they're being fed bad information. But for doctors, they're supposed to know better. You know, they're supposed to be, you know, detached, objective, dispassionate, and they know medicine and they know science better than the woman does. So right. I think that's part of the rationale for focusing on just doctors.
So sort of situationally on a case-by-case basis, not saying that it would be justified, but you can at least, there would at least be some circumstances where the woman, you could argue, either doesn't fully realize what's happening or doesn't really understand that the child growing inside her is in fact a life. But when it comes to the prosecution side of this, there's absolutely no excuse for the doctor. I mean, this guy is typically speaking, especially the ones where they have ultrasound guided procedures, they're looking at the baby as this is taking place. They know what's going on. And that's sort of the reason that the focus of all the legislation, even by the most staunch pro-lifers that I've seen, don't include prosecution for the woman, but specifically prosecute the doctor himself.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So, you know, in most cases nowadays, you're right. The, you know, the doctors are able to have access to things like ultrasounds to guide them through through an abortion to make sure that they don't, you know, harm the woman while they're doing this. So they should know what they're doing better than the woman does. Mm-hmm. But even if they don't have something like that, they've had things like medical training. They should know, you know, the science behind, you know, what's going on with the baby, and they should know better than the woman that this is actually a person and is completely human. So I think that's the rationale for focusing on doctors. So with that said, one thing I'm really hoping that this law will accomplish, like even if the ACLU sued over this tomorrow, let's say Governor Ivey signs this into law at 10 o'clock tomorrow and the ACLU files a complaint at about 10:01.
Right.
Because abortionists are now in the crosshairs and because they could be facing up to 99 years in prison if they go ahead and do the abortion anyway, I'm hoping that this will at least get them to stop dead in their tracks until, you know, this litigation is resolved. And in the meantime, you have a lot of lives being saved as the courts work out whether this law is constitutional or not.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Matt. We certainly appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. And is there anything else we ought to know about this that you can think of just sort of off the top of your head before we take off?
The short answer is not really. I would just say, you know, please be praying for you know, for Governor Ivey, for the courage to sign the bill, and then wisdom for the Alabama Attorney General's office as they try to figure out how to defend this law in court. Because my hope is that they can not only defend the law, but that they can seize this as an opportunity to say, while we're on the subject, part of the reason why this law should be upheld is the fact that unborn children actually are people. Mm-hmm. And if they seize on that opportunity and they take it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and if the court buys that argument, then we can finally see the end of abortion in the United States. So be praying for the AG's office. If they play their cards right, this could do a lot of good.
Always good advice to tell people to pray about it. Well, thank you so much, Matt. We appreciate you being with us. Matt Clark at the Foundation for Moral Law. Thanks. And we really do appreciate you coming on and sort of clearing up that for us.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Caleb. Really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Have a good one, Matt. So again, that is Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law. We appreciate him being on here. This is a really huge deal, and it's important that if we're going to have a discussion with anybody about it, it's important that we have an honest discussion. It's important that we know the facts. We know exactly what this bill is going to do. And even though on this issue specifically, because it's such an emotional one for so many people, it's hard to have a rational discussion. Being armed with the facts and not misrepresenting what the bill actually does is a good way to do that. So I tell you what we're going to do. We're quickly running out of time here because, again, it's Wednesday and I got to get to Bible class. I know many of you have to get to Bible class. So we will take a quick break and we'll be back to discuss this a little bit more in depth.
And now for a reading from the Social Justice Warrior Bible with Pastor Gregory Post.
Welcome in. I'm Gregory Post, head pastor at the Eternal Living Word Transdenominational Community Church and Coffee House in Novato, California. And now for a reading from the SJW Bible. Today's reading will be from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 7, verses 2 through 10. And a centurion slave was sick and about to die. When he had heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come save the life of his slave. When they came to Jesus, they earnestly implored him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built our synagogue." Now Jesus was triggered upon hearing this and said, "None of the good things he has done matter because he is a slave owner, and we must never admit that anyone that ever owned slaves is capable of doing anything good. Furthermore, instead of asking me for help, you should have passed universal health care by now so that he could receive treatment for free." Then Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I am also a man placed under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him, and turned and said to the crowd that was following him, "I say to you, this man is engaged in systematic oppression. He is clearly engaging in wage slavery by controlling the means of production to exploit the labor of those around him." Then Jesus gathered up a mob and protested on the centurion's lawn all night long with torches and signs reading, "Down with the patriarchy," terrifying him and his family. We never really found out what happened to the centurion's slave. Wow. So inspiring. Thank you for listening to this reading of the SJW Bible. And remember, the only truth that matters is your truth.
Welcome back. And of course, we have been talking about the abortion ban that has been passed by the Senate. It passed cleanly. In other words, no amendments. There were not exceptions that were added to this in the case of rape or incest, which is important because that is strengthening the argument for it to essentially establish the personhood of the unborn. And so there's a number of reasons why this bill really is a big deal. It is the most serious challenge to Roe v. Wade, where it's certainly the most extreme, the most pointed at establishing personhood of the individual inside the womb that there has ever been. And so based on the makeup of the court and based on the law itself, that's going to greatly affect the outcome of this case. Who knows? It may not even make it to the Supreme Court. It's all up in the air right now. Even though I doubt this would happen, Governor Ivey could also veto it. But nonetheless, this is a big deal. The fact that this has actually gone through in a state, and I would want to point out, too, before we go any further, Doug Jones, I saw tweeting about this morning right after just sort of looking at how he reacted to it. They call the guy Abortion Jones for a reason. The guy is absolutely for abortion in all of its forms, any way you can have it. And Doug Jones was actually tweeting out this morning and said that when it comes to abortion, that when it comes to abortion and the way that the Alabama legislature wound up passing it, he said, "I cannot believe that the actions of the Alabama Senate, this bill being passed, reflects the views of the average Alabamian." Now, I don't know if Doug Jones is actually this delusional. I tend to think that he's not. I think he's just trying to make a point. But this is a guy who believes that abortion ought to take place and be legal in this country because he voted for this up until the point of birth, and he is criticizing the Alabama Senate for its views being out of line, out of step with the average Alabamian. The view that Doug Jones has, after voting against a 25-week ban on abortion, which most European countries don't even have a measure that long, the views that Doug Jones have is shared by 13% of Americans. And I would imagine most of that 13% is not living in Alabama. See, you can't be critical of the Senate passing a measure that is outside the views and the beliefs of the average Alabamian when you yourself are espousing a belief that is maybe held by a significantly less than, I would guess, 13%, but at the absolute max, 13%. Of Alabamians. Jones is the one that is wildly out of step with Alabama's views on abortion. And furthermore, I don't buy into this claim. I do not accept this premise that this bill somehow is misrepresentative of the average Alabamian's belief when it comes to abortion. In fact, the vast majority of Alabamians I've talked to, again, this isn't polling, this is just anecdotal evidence, I understand that, but the vast, vast majority of them understand that the person in the womb is actually a person. And because of that, then it is important to preserve their life, even in cases of rape or incest. And again, like I said the other day, I don't understand why incest is always included in this. I mean, at least with rape, that was something that was, you know, horrifically committed against the person in most cases that would be the one getting pregnant. But I don't understand at all trying to lump those two in together. But this is all supposedly outlining, and I'll make this point real quick, and then we'll get to the phones, because it looks like we have a caller on the line here. Hollywood, of all places, reacted very violently to this, as you can imagine. They were not real happy with this. There were several celebrities, including Alyssa Milano and Chris Evans, the guy who plays Captain America, and I think he's in Scott Pilgrim and a couple of other movies. But anyway, so a lot of the celebrities have come out and tried to address this and talked about how horrific it is and tried to call Alabama backwards and that sort of thing. And the irony in all of this is that you've got a group of people that it is literally their job to pretend to be something. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's honest work, but let's be honest, it's not the most strenuous thing in the world. That it is actually their job to pretend to be something that they're not, saying that Alabama is phony on this, that they're just virtue signaling, that this isn't going to actually take into effect. I saw several celebrities posting essentially the same thing, saying that, well, Alabama is being disingenuous here. It's like, you're an actor. That's your job, to pretend to be something that you're not. And furthermore, we actually do have reaction, and I wanted to share this. We actually do have reaction to Alabama, and the state of Alabama issued an official response to the Hollywood actors and their sort of hatred for this bill. Here it goes.
You know, I can't believe I even thought of getting back together with you. We are so over.
Fine by me!
So Ross there, of course, being the state of Alabama, the idea that we're really concerned about what a bunch of actors and actresses in Hollywood think of us is absurd. Now, at least in Georgia, when they threatened to pull out of Georgia and not do any more business in Georgia, that was at least a credible threat. Georgia does draw a lot of money from having films and TV shows and that kind of thing shot in Georgia. And I do appreciate that their governor, Governor Kemp, has actually said, look, we're going to do what's right regardless of how it affects us economically. That did take a fair bit of courage. But in the state of Alabama, they're also trying to make this case that, well, we're just going to stop doing business in Alabama. And I'm sitting here like, when was the last time a movie was actually shot in Alabama? And I thought about it. The only one that I can come up with was Woodlawn was shot partially in Alabama. But that was done by a Christian company, and I kind of doubt that they would have a problem with shooting in Alabama because of this abortion bill. And then the other one that I could think of was Big Fish. You remember Tim Burton? He shot that in parts of Montgomery, Wetumpka, right here in the river region. And so that one was shot in Alabama, but that was like, what, over a decade ago now? And so I'm trying to figure out where all this business coming in from Hollywood is going to benefit Alabama in the first place. And so them threatening to not do business in Alabama anymore, that's not really much of a threat. That'd be like me saying, you know what, from now on, I refuse to grow tomatoes in Canada. Like, well, you can't really grow tomatoes in Canada. You don't really do that a whole lot, so that's not much of a threat. But nonetheless, that's what they're threatening on doing now. It looks like we have a caller on line one, so let's go ahead and go to the phones. Good afternoon. What's your name?
Hey, it's John. Listen, I think this is a day for celebration.
I agree.
This is the biggest day in the moment and time for the state of Alabama in a very long time.
I don't think I've ever been prouder to be a citizen of the state of Alabama than today.
Me either.
In fact,
it's one of the greatest things that has happened. We're a leader in this thing, mm-hmm. and I don't know where it's going to go, but I sure am glad that we're trying to set the precedent for this thing and moving forward so that it will have an impact on the court, and at least we will get the opportunity for it to be overturned.
If this thing winds up happening and Alabama is the state that caused Roe v. Wade to be overturned or to get abortion outlawed nationally as a whole, I propose a new state motto.
I thought about that.
Alabama, yeah. Home of the abolition movement.
How about the right to life state?
Yeah. Well, right now it's we dare to defend our rights. How about we dare to defend life?
Yeah.
Just a small adjustment.
Like that. I think that would be worthwhile. And we should celebrate that. There should. And I mean that because.
I'm not being facetious. I'm 100%. I mean everything I'm saying.
Listen, I can remember in the fourth and fifth grade that this was an issue and there was controversy when I was in elementary school about this, about which direction we need to go. And I'm 55 now. And I was around 10 years old. That's been 45 years ago. That's a long time that this thing has been going on. And the innocent children have been victims of this incredibly barbaric policy that has been in our country, that's been a plague to us. And I just think it's a great day to celebrate. I really do. And I was proud of our people for standing up for what's right. And also, the biggest thing, like Becky was talking about, they didn't let the amendments become a part of it either.
Yeah, honestly, I thought for sure that they were going to get the exception in. I really did.
I thought that, too. I thought that might happen. But thank goodness, and surely to goodness, Kay Ivey has no other alternative except to sign it.
I don't foresee her vetoing this. I mean, goodness knows that I don't mind criticizing Governor Ivey, as I've done many times. But on this, she's pretty solid. I don't ever remember her doing anything that wouldn't be pro-life, so far as I can remember back in her political career. So I see no reason to believe that Governor Ivey won't sign this into law.
Yeah. Well, I've been taking – some people have been taking some shots at me for some of the views that I've posted. So that would be interesting to see the kind of positions that other people are going to take that are staunch abortionists.
Well, to play along with that, one of the things that I'm seeing over and over again as a criticism of Alabama is, and I'm sure you've heard this too if you've been listening to any of the people on the pro-choice side of the argument, they've constantly said, oh, well, Alabama's just a backward state, and it's because they're... Is there anything more backward than paganistic child sacrifice for your own convenience? That's something that predates recorded history. They're acting like we're the ones that are backward and we're the ones that are inhumane. But if you're looking through the history of the human race, that's a practice that went on so far back we don't even know when it started. And so they're really the ones engaged in a archaic institution.
Well, I'm okay with Alyssa Milano being the face of the opposition to this.
That was my favorite thing. In fact, I think since you brought that up, I have a graphic here, if I'm not mistaken. There we go. This is a tweet that went out from Alyssa Milano earlier this week, where she says, our reproductive rights are being erased. Until women have legal control over our own bodies, we just cannot risk pregnancy. Join me by not having sex until we have bodily autonomy back. I'm calling for a sex strike. Pass it on. Which
yeah,
I think
end abortion right there.
I know that's exactly how I responded. I was like, well, if all the pro-choice women are going to suddenly stop having sex, then we have no abortion problem.
Yeah, we
don't even have to make abortion illegal if that's the case.
They're not going to give up illicit sex in the Hollywood crowd. That's for sure.
No, and that's the thing. For the first time that I can ever remember, Alyssa Milano and I are on the same page when it comes to abortion policy. Alyssa couldn't agree with you more. Let's do that.
Take care.
Yeah, you have a good one. But yeah, that was a really dumb thing for her to mention, and it's yet one more example of Hollywood trying to insert themselves into the policy because they believe, I guess, that they're smarter or wiser or better than the rest of us, and that their opinions count more because they happen to be really good at acting. Not sure what that has to do with policymaking, but nonetheless, they have a big platform. They're allowed to speak their mind however they want to use it. And we're also allowed to make fun of them when they say something absurdly stupid like Alyssa Milano typically does. Now, since we're on the topic, well, I tell you what, we'll probably have to save this one for tomorrow because I am running low on time and we probably need to go ahead and get to the chaplain's report. So We'll have to deal with that tomorrow, but I did want to, before I do that, deal with just one more thing that it has often been brought up as a point of contention by the left, and you're going to hear this a lot over the next couple hours, which is why I want to go ahead and get this in before we actually see the before we actually see all of this take place. You've got the people that are saying that Alabama's backwards, and like I'm saying, you can't come up with an older idea than child sacrifice for your own convenience. That's the way that pagans did it. They believed that their gods were going to reward them for sacrificing their children, and so that they would be economically or emotionally more satisfied and more stable and didn't want to have to deal with the rigors of parenthood, they would kill their children. That's an old, old idea. It's not something new. It's not something progressive. And I guess it's because they live in the history of now that they believe that they're the only people that have ever thought of abortion. No, abortion has been around for a very, 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 very long time. And I'm not even talking about equating it like I just did to child sacrifice of those that are already living. People have been aborting their children in the womb forever. It's an archaic, barbaric practice. There were Native American tribes, for example, that would drink certain things that would cause them to lose the child inside of them, to essentially expel that pregnancy from their bodies. This was also true in several ancient cultures across the Atlantic Ocean. There's record of it in the Middle East, in European countries, and at the founding, Joseph Story, who wrote the first law book ever published in the United States of America, he literally wrote the book on American law. This is a guy that was one of the original Supreme Court justices. He was appointed by George Washington himself. He wrote in one of his in his very first American law book that if anybody gives a woman a potion to end her pregnancy, this is murder. And that the person involved in giving her that potion ought to be prosecuted. So they can act as though this is a new phenomenon, that we just now have it because of this technology. Abortion is something that was struggled with and has been a plague on humankind since its very beginning, essentially. Since before we even have recorded history on a lot of that stuff. And when it comes to American law, we have the founder of the concept of American common law saying that the law, the Constitution, the right to life is protected under that law in the form of Joseph Story. And so there's really not an argument, no matter how you try to tackle it, no matter what angle you come at, that you can make the case that this is some kind of a new idea. Alabama is trying to progress, ironically, away from this this barbaric practice of killing your own children. And so, even though I don't think that forward thinking for the sense of being forward is always a good thing, sometimes forward thinking really means it's just a bad idea and no one's tried it for a reason. I don't think that that in and of itself makes something a moral good just because it's a different idea that nobody has had before. But if you're looking throughout human history and you're looking at Alabama and the law that we have that bans abortion versus the entirety of the rest of the human race, abortion has been practiced a lot longer than Alabama's abortion ban. So the idea that we're backwards really doesn't make any sense when you add just a tiny bit of perspective to it. It becomes very abundantly clear that Alabama is actually the one that is forward-thinking in protecting the rights of the unborn, not the reverse. And we're going back to our original roots, our original promise of the Constitution that preserves, first and foremost, life. And another thing that's important to note, too, because I've been hearing this all day as well, that the Democrats are saying, and I find this pretty hilarious, they're saying that this whole thing is a Trojan horse. This whole thing is just set up to end Roe v. Wade. And I'm sitting here watching this all day thinking, well, yeah, that was the purpose. The representative that sponsored this bill, Terry Collins, came on this program and discussed that specifically with me. Representative Mike Holmes, who was in favor of this bill and voted for it, came on this program, discussed it with me. Becky Gerritsen, who is involved with Eagle Forum Alabama. She has spoken directly with the person that actually wrote this bill and was involved in the debate process when it was working its way through the House and Senate. She spoke with me. All three of them all said, with absolutely no hesitation whatsoever, this bill is specifically designed to overturn Roe v. Wade. They're acting as though Republicans are lying to you, or they're trying to hide the ball, and what this is really about is it's really about overturning Roe v. Wade. And we're all sitting here like, well, yeah, we said that from the very beginning. We're not trying to deceive anybody. We're not trying to act as though, well, this is just about outlawing it in Alabama. No, we said from the very beginning, this bill was written specifically, crafted in such a way that it was supposed to overturn Roe v. Wade. And so when a person tries to criticize the bill or try to criticize the state of Alabama by trying to suggest that there is some kind of nefarious secret goal underneath, well, no, the goal's out in the open. We told you that getting Roe v. Wade overturned was the end game here. That's what we actually wanted. So anyone that says that, you can tell pretty quickly is not interested in having an honest discussion or is either completely ignorant about the law and how it came about. So there's a couple reasons there that it's pretty easy to see who's really up on top of things and who really understands what's going on and who is either woefully misinformed about the bill or is intentionally trying to lie to you, saying that the Republicans are hiding the ball here. They're really not. Now let's go on and go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Our chaplain's report today does come from, we're going to take a quick break from the book of Daniel, and I wanted to, because of what has happened today and the, of course, the big news story, the media firestorm that resulted because of the abortion law, I thought it was important to look at a verse that really sort of reflects that. And there are countless verses that I could go to talking about how abortion is wrong and how God creates life in the womb, and he has a specific plan for each person that he has even before they were born. There's a mountain of scripture I could have chosen from on that. There is no shortage of scripture that decries the shedding of innocent blood, so on and so forth. You probably are already aware of all these scriptures. But I wanted to go back to principle. I wanted to actually, instead of talking about the Bible's negative commands and how it talks about abortion is wrong, and it is, and it's appropriate that we can look through the scripture and see that, I think it's also important to realize why abortion is wrong. I think it's important to realize why, in principle, there is nothing loving or compassionate about abortion, and in fact, it's the exact opposite. And I can think of no better verse to do that than to look at some of Christ's own words in the form of Matthew chapter 25, verse 40. The king will answer and say to them, "Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me." What's important to understand about this verse is Christ had just finished a very elegant speech explaining the importance of taking care of those around you, taking care of your brothers and sisters, those that are hungry or thirsty or imprisoned or impoverished, that in each of these scenarios, the Christian thing to do, the morally correct thing to do, is to do everything within your power to try to help them. And it's such a reversal of the Christian virtue. You see, one of the things that we also see earlier in Christ's ministry is that he talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, going the extra mile. And I'm not even saying that as a Turner phrase, because that's actually the origin of the phrase, go the extra mile. that Jesus instructed, if somebody asks you to go a mile with them, then you go too. If somebody asks you for a coat, you give them your cloak also. It's part of the bedrock foundation of Christianity that you love one another, and that if that love causes you to make a sacrifice, then that's actually something you should be not only willing, not only able, but willing to do. One of the things that is talked about as part of the Christian virtue, as part of the selfless love of Christ and of God, is that we should be able to put up with inconveniences or even stress that's far greater than inconvenience, even putting ourselves in danger, if it means doing what's right for another, for serving another, and for protecting them. And here we see Christ in the book of Matthew saying that if you have done any of these things to even the least of these, the least of these that are my fellow brothers under our common Father, God the Father, then it's as if you've done it to me. And you see, that's really why abortion is incorrect. We can talk about the fact that God says it's incorrect, therefore it's incorrect, and that is also a valid statement. But the reason that God has said that it is incorrect is because it is wrong for you to put your own desires, your own wants, your own needs, or your own comfort ahead of the needs of another. You see, hatred, it can certainly be the kind of hatred that we all think about, malice. In other words, you actively pull against somebody, you actively hate somebody, you actively do evil things to them. But it can also be apathy, because hatred is just a lack of love. And so, while it could certainly take the form of malice or wrath, hatred can also take the form of apathy. Someone that is so unconcerned with other people that takes no thought of them or what's right for them or what's best for them, that they act on their own selfish impulses and don't really care who it hurts. Those are attributes that could also be ascribed to somebody that wants there to be elective abortion still allowed. Somebody that is so concerned with what they do with, quote-unquote, their body. And I won't go into the arguments against that right now because it's not the purpose. But they're so concerned with what happens to them, they completely disconnect themselves from the fact that they're hurting somebody else. That they are robbing somebody of all of their choices so that they can make one choice on their own. That they are taking the life and the right of another in order to satisfy their own convenience, in order to not inconvenience themselves with the burden of a child. I think that, like so many of the problems in our country, in fact, most of the problems in our country, this issue would be resolved virtually instantaneously if all we did was remember to act upon the Christian virtue of love. There's so many problems in this country that if we just did that, if we just acted in a way that is Christ-like and conformed ourselves to God's will, primarily through the method of loving each other, and of course understanding that in Christianity, love means sacrificing that which you want for another. If we just applied that principle, the same principle that Jesus applies to us every single day, and did so at the cross to forgive us of our sins, then we wouldn't have to worry about this issue, and we wouldn't have to worry about most of the issues facing us as a people. So let's endeavor every single day to try to act more on this, to give of ourselves, so that we may really find a way to love others. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.